Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Ellen Brown on today, my favorite financial guru. Who else but Ellen Brown to really fill us in on all the stuff you'll never read in the New York Times. You'll never hear anything about it on television, but you'll hear about it on this program when Ellen Brown comes on to give us a rundown. She's got a brand new article. My God, I've been waiting for the ink to dry, Ellen. We'll talk about Ellen's brand new article, literally hot off the press, about a my goodness, Richmond, California, a mayor. Ellen calls her a bowl mayor, who literally, Richmond, California, I mean, a tiny dot on the map, going up against the titans of Wall Street. That's Ellen's newest program and newest article, and two others we'll talk about, where she talked about the credit card gravy train. My goodness, I mean, Ellen even surprised. I had to think about it. And, of course, what she said makes absolute sense, that even people like me who pay off their credit card balances every single month, I have never run up one penny in debt to the credit card thieves, and they still scam me. They still scam me. You can't get away from those, you know what. Those SOBs, I mean, they're going to get you. They have a real racket going. There are a lot of rackets in America. I mean, Wall Street is a racket. My goodness, it's probably the biggest racket overall. But there are sub-rackets that go on Wall Street. And we've certainly talked about those in the program, and we will again. And I've had my say about them as well. We'll get into more on the credit card racket. The student loan debt racket is one of the big ones that obsesses me, because when I went to college, when Ellen went, a little bit after I did in graduate school, whole different world that we lived in. Before we get into the program, let me just mention one thing off the track. We'll talk a little bit about Ukraine and about Venezuela later in the program. Two more countries Obama wants imperial trophies for. He thinks he's got one in Ukraine. He may have one. He may not have one. He certainly doesn't know Venezuela yet, but he's trying. He wants two more countries brought into the U.S. fold. We've talked plenty about it. And today I'm literally writing since Thursday, my 7th and 8th articles on Ukraine. The only other time I did anything like this with such intensity was a period, over a year ago. Don't remember the exact time frame, but there was breaking stuff happening in Syria day after day, multiple things to talk about, too much to get into a single article. And I was writing multiple articles every day, and I turned out about the same volume. I think there was one day I wrote three articles on Syria, and I don't think, well, I did that once on Ukraine. I did it because I did an article that really was the next day, but it got dated the previous day. So it really was two in one day and a third on the following day. They went out with the same date on it. It made it look as though I did three in one day. But once on Syria, I literally did three in one day because there was so much to address, and I didn't want to cram too much in one article, because if they get too long, people won't read them. And I usually don't write short articles because it's just too much of importance that you need to include to explain things properly to readers. One quick thing, and we'll get to Ellen's articles. We'll start with the credit card business. Today, the Sochi Olympics wrapped up. I'm not a big Olympics fan. I literally didn't watch a single moment of the Olympics or the Summer Olympics before it, or I can't remember the last time I watched any Olympics events. I'm not an Olympics fan. I've got lots of good reasons for that, but I won't go into them. But I'll say congratulations to Vladimir Putin and to the Russian athletes. I certainly have great respect for the athletes, and I have great respect for the people who put such an immense effort into these Winter Games, let me put it that way. Russia ended up on top of the Olympics medals count. They won the most total medals. They won the most gold medals. I'm not certain how things were predicted to come out before the games began, but my guess would probably be that this was at least a mild upset. What better for the host country than to come out on top? And I'm certainly very, very happy for Vladimir Putin and the people of Russia and the Russian athletes. It's their moment of glory. Russia, Sochi, about 9 hours ahead of Chicago time, which is a little bit after midday, New York time, a little bit after 1 p.m., California time, a little bit after 10 a.m. So in Russia, it's getting well into the evening. Their time after 9 p.m. in the evening, getting kind of late. I'm certain the celebrations are going on very, very, very exuberantly, and indeed they deserve them. And I'll be very happy to see the commercials for Sochi disappear, the ones that I never watched because I'm not an Olympics fan. Ellen, welcome. That was a rather extensive warm-up, but I absolutely wanted to get my congratulations in for the Russian Olympic team. I was very surprised. I had not kept count of the medals winnings. I can't name a single athlete, not a single one, who participated or won anything. And the last Olympics I really remember was back in 1972 when the great tragedy happened, and I was concerned if there could be another repeat of Olympics terror. In 1972, I believe there were 11 Israeli athletes killed by a group called Black September. Very, very great tragedy. None of that should ever happen. I think security really began to be ramped up after that happened, and there was immense security put into this event. I saw the figure $2 billion, and I saw the figure $50 billion spent overall to put on these games. I can think of much better ways to spend $50 billion. Ellen, welcome.
Thanks, Stephen.
There's certainly a better way to spend money, Ellen. There's so much good that needs to be done in the world that isn't. And instead of creating artificial snow, I'd rather create real benefits for people who need them.
Yeah, or maybe create some real snow here in California.
You could use anything to get some mocha. You are really going through a terrible situation. Worst drought in 100 years?
So it is said, and, well, I don't want to go into that in here because I'm not very well-versed on it, but I've certainly read some heavy theories about why that is. It's manipulated by military interests, et cetera.
Well, whether it's climate-related or not, I have no idea, or whether it's deliberately manipulated, I don't idea. I really do believe that climate can be manipulated, and I think the powers that be in America have done that, not just climate, but forest fires, earthquakes. I remember writing about the Haiti earthquake 2010, 2011, lose track of the date. It's been a few years ago, and I certainly couldn't say for sure, Ellen, but I had very strong suspicions that the earthquake was not natural, that it was manipulated to happen, and there were lots of good reasons to say that, which is a different topic. I don't think I ever discussed that on this program, but it's a different topic, and I'll let it pass for now. But it all comes down to bottom-line profits. And I wonder whether what's going on in California, Ellen, if it was manipulated, whether the profit motive is involved in that, because if the crops don't grow and there aren't enough of what people need, and California really is the breadbasket of America for so many crops, the Midwest, the breadbasket for grains, but California for fruits and lots of vegetables, and if that stuff isn't produced in enough quantities, you're going to see the prices soar. You're going to see agribusiness make an awful lot of money. So that would be a good motive for doing something like this.
Yeah. Well, I'm not well enough versed. I mean, I read a lot on those subjects, but I guess I don't want to go into it either. Pretty conspiratorial.
Talk about the credit cards.
You know, we used to have routine. We used to have earthquakes here all the time. I mean, in L.A., you could always feel little earthquakes, and they quit. We haven't had earthquakes, I don't think, in the last 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I read, this is totally a conspiracy theory, but I read somewhere that there was a mad scientist at Livermore Labs who was experimenting with earthquakes. He was named, but I can't remember what his name was, but apparently he actually passed away. But they were preparing for this use of weaponized weather abroad, which they now have made good use of, so it is said.
Well, I went through one in San Diego when I lived there for less than 2 years. At most, it was a point. It was a 4.0 at most. I think it was even less than that. But I was on the 10th floor of my office building, and the damn thing shook like crazy, and I didn't know what to do. And I was on the telephone when it started. It probably lasted about 30, 45 seconds. I had a second phone. It began ringing. I picked it up. I was literally on two phones at the same time. The other one was my wife, terrified at home as to what should she do. And I'm shaking my head saying, what should I do? Should I get under the desk? You don't want to take an elevator, but it could be a pretty scary thing. If a 4.0 was as scary as I felt when this thing was going on, you can imagine what something big feels like. Absolute terror. But again, it's a different issue, and let's get into the credit card thing. It's a real scam. Everybody is scammed. If you use a credit card, you're going to get scammed. These people have a gravy train going for them. And you wrote two articles about it, Ellen. Explain it.
Well, credit cards, as you say, even if you pay your bill every month, as most people do, and they actually want you to, they make more money on the people who do pay their bills than the people who don't. The people who pay their bills every month still pay, the merchants pay 2% on average on every single transaction. And these loans are for only, on average, 25 days. So if you project 2% on 25% days over the whole year, you compound it over the year, it comes out to 33%, and I've read figures higher than that, 60% or so. But the banks are making a huge return on this, and I would say on their money, but it's not even their money. That's the catch. That's another catch, that they're actually using your own money. When you go to the store and you sign the little credit card slip, that is a negotiable instrument under UCC law. That is actually money. So that payment slip goes back into the merchant's account and is credited toward the merchant. But these loans are also short, that basically the bank is just monetizing your own credit, and then you pay off your bill within a month, and so you actually pay the thing. So anyway, once they get this whole thing rolling, they've just got credits on top of credits, and they don't even need to use their own money, and they don't have to use their depositors' money. So they're making interest on something that's not even an investment of their own money, and they're making a very nice return on that. We, meanwhile, are paying 2% on every single thing we buy, every blouse, every it's like a sales tax, but it's much worse than a sales tax in the sense that a sales tax is money that goes back to the government. I mean, we all know that we have to pay these taxes, but that's how the government pays for the services that we get. But we don't get any services out of the bank that collects this 2% fee. That's just their profit, which then goes usually into offshore tax havens or, you know, into their own speculative investments that typically are working against us rather than working for us. So that's the downside of the whole thing. But what I always like to conclude with is that we could turn this system to our advantage. There are two possibilities. If we had our own publicly owned banks, we could either reduce the merchant's fees. That's what they do in Costa Rica, where 80% of their banks are publicly owned, or 80% of deposits are in publicly owned banks. And those banks actually do the credit card thing, but they have very reduced fees for their merchants. So the merchants love it, and they all pile into the public banks. If we did that, we could definitely be a huge draw for the merchants into our public banks, and even arguably allow the too big to fail banks to fail because we don't need them anymore. But the other alternative, the problem with doing that in the U.S. is that Visa and MasterCard have preset fees, and so if you're going to use Visa and MasterCard, you have to charge that 2% fee to the merchant. So let's say the public bank did that, charge the 2% fee to the merchant. The public bank could be making these 30% plus returns a year. So we, the people, could be recapturing that fee, which would be a huge revenue source for our public, or for our local governments, which through their public banks, the way that North Dakota gets the revenues of the Bank of North Dakota. But so that's another source of revenue besides the interest that you would recapture by owning your own bank. You could recapture the credit card fees, and they could recapture the fees that they're paying themselves. Like in San Francisco, they pay, I think it's $4 million for credit card fees just for the city of San Francisco, city and county.
The arguments for public banking just keep growing, Ellen. The arguments are so overwhelming, and the arguments against the major banks and the way they rip off people and really just stick their hand in our pockets and steal our money. The arguments against them just keep piling up on the other side of the ledger. What about debit cards? Do they work like credit cards?
for it used to be that for both debit and credit cards, the merchant was not allowed to charge less for cash. And that was part of the deal. If you wanted to take Visa, whether it was a debit card or a credit card, you had to sign Visa's agreement, which was that the merchant always paid this 2% fee. But then there was a recent lawsuit in New York where brought by some merchants, and so, or a big collection of merchants, and the banks were forced to agree to allow a reduction for cash or debit cards. But there are some states where that's still not allowed. In California, I saw that California was one of them, but I heard of somebody saying that they did see a cash discount. Well, I know ARCO, of course, gives cash discounts, but I don't think they take credit cards at all. Anyway, up until recently, there was no advantage to buying in cash or debit for the merchant or for the consumer. Of course, that extra 2% is going to get passed on to the consumers. It's passed on to the prices that we pay.
Well, I use a debit card. I don't use a credit card anymore. But I have a favorite vendor that I buy things from all the time, necessities that I need. And for a good while before I began using a debit card, Ellen, I said to them, I don't want to give you a credit card because in my naivete, I said, I know it comes out of your revenues. I had no idea that you know, we all get socked for this kind of scam. But I was thinking of them. I wanted to save them money. And they knew me very well. They knew I would welch on them. And I just said, send me a statement along with the merchandise that you ship, and I'll write a check. And I'll put it to you in the mail, which I hate to do, but I wanted them to max out revenue-wise on what they were selling me. I didn't want them to be cheated, so I did it that way. And then when I got a debit card, I began using that. I'm going to have to check to see whether they are being cheated in any way. My card is a Visa card. I don't want them to be cheated, because if they are, I'll just go back to asking them to send me an invoice, and I'll write them a check, and that for certain. I don't know what the banks do when they cash a check. Do they scam us on that end too, Ellen?
And no, that's the thing. They don't make a fee usually for check cashing. Nowadays, of course, they're starting to charge fees for your deposit account unless you keep a certain minimum in it. Yeah, so they are getting us coming and going. But the reason they make more money on the people who do pay their bill every month than the people who don't pay their bill every month is that if you do pay your bill, then they can keep rolling over this this pile of money that they've accumulated from other people paying their bills. They can keep rolling that over and make the 30% per year. But if you don't pay your bill, then they have to, typically they securitize it, sell it off to somebody else, and it's to investors, and or if they keep it themselves, they're still only making whatever, 16% or 18% or whatever, but they're not making the 30%, they're only making 18%. So they'd rather have the people that pay off their bills every month,
so the
ironically.
The difference is if you pay off your bill, they get your hands on your money, and if you don't pay off your bill, they don't get their hands on your money.
Right, and if they get their hands on your money, they're making a better return with this 2% every 25 days than they would be if they charge their credit card interest rate.
That's a little bit like the student loan racket, Ellen, because the companies involved in student loans, Sallie Mae and the other ones involved, they prefer to have students not pay off their debt. They prefer them to default, to not pay at all, because it's impossible to get out from under student loan debt. Unless maybe you die. I don't know about your heirs. Maybe if you die, you get out from under it. If you leave the country, I guess you get out from under it. But as long as you're in this country and alive and breathing, if you default on your debt and you're working, they can garnish your wages. If you're retired, they can garnish your Social Security or your pension. There's no way to get out from under this. And if you default on your debt, then the interest starts accumulating and compounding, so they make a fortune this way. So I guess that's a little bit comparable to the credit card companies. They don't want you paying off your debt. They want you delaying it. They want the interest to pile up and compound. And ideally, they want you to default. fault, so they can literally steal everything you have. I don't know about your home, but they sure can steal plenty and just rob you blind for people who simply can't get out of this onerous burden. And Ellen, when you and I were back in school, it was a whole different world.
Yeah, and the worst part of it, I think, is what it's just the whole mentality of this financialization of everything. Like, big companies like GE aren't inventing things anymore because they make more money by being credit card companies, by issuing credit for their customers and keeping this whole credit thing going, than by investing in development, product development, and innovation. So we have this whole system where everybody thinks that the best way to make money is to have your money making money, to be a trader on Wall Street, and you can make oodles of money. But how do you do it? You're skimming the profits from somebody else. You're just taking other people's money that they've, whoever is making the real products, you're taking the profits from them, and so they're less and less of them, and more of the people who are the parasites living off of the other people making money. So you just can't sustain a system that way. I think the flaw in the system, in the whole conception, is our conception of what money is. The whole idea that money is your promise to pay is a good one, but the problem is you don't need to be collecting interest on that. It's my promise to pay. There's no reason that I didn't borrow it from somebody else, so there's no reason that I should be paying interest to somebody else or fees to somebody else. We could set up a system that is totally a public utility, like just a great computer in the sky that figures out who owes what to whom. And so if you do a service for somebody, but you're not ready to collect their service in return yet, then you just get a credit in the great computer in the sky. Maybe you want to save it for retirement. That's fine. But your credits don't need to grow of their own accord. I mean, they don't need to be attracting interest so that they're getting bigger and bigger. You just get your credits. And, I mean, here's what I would envision for, I was just talking about this with my kids last night because we had a family gathering. Always a stimulant to hear what the kids are thinking. It seems to me that the ideal system would be one where you have all your needs covered. We know we don't need as many workers now as we used to because of mechanization, and people are worried about where the jobs going to be. Well, you only need as many jobs as you need. So let's say you had a system where everybody had to work for 10 years at 10 hours a week, because that's probably all we really need if you get down to the real basics. So everybody has to put in that much time. And so you do that, and then you're allowed to retire after that, basically. But you have to collect a certain amount of credits. But your credits don't grow. They're only good for meeting the threshold requirement for allowing you to then retire and pursue things that you find really interesting. Like, I'm technically retired, and what I do with my time is I mean, I've never been so busy and I've never worked so hard, but I'm writing on subjects that I think are keenly interesting, that I think people need to know about. I mean, it seems to me that if you had a what they used to call the leisure class in the Middle Ages, it was the responsibility of the leisure class to do art and literature and science and writing. Well, that's literature, but anyway, to pursue all these things that the workers didn't have time for. So anyway, if you free people up, they will do good things with their free time, I think. But you have to have a certain amount of time that everybody puts in working to produce the things that are necessary to maintain these shells that we live in called bodies. And to show that you've done that, you would get a certain amount of credits, but not credits that reproduce themselves through interest.
Ellen, we're both in the same business. I have never been more active in my life. I remember I thought the busiest time of my life was when I was in grad school, because I wanted to cram a two-year curriculum into a year and a half in a summer and get a master's thesis written at the same time. And it's amazing how much you can get done when you set your mind to it. But literally, about the only time I ever took any time off with equally busy friends, they seemed equally busy to me, was Saturday night when would go out for a pizza and a beer or something or other and just relax for a few hours. And the rest of the week, 6.5 days, we were toiling away. And now I'm at least as active as I was then. I think I'm even more active than I was then. Well, then, you know, it was a labor to get what we called back in business school a union card. If you go to law school, to an extent, it's the same thing. But of course, you're learning the law. In business, you really get trained. And that's what you get trained for. You get a union card. Is what you got, and you come out with that union card, and you really begin your education when you go to work for somebody. That's when you really start learning stuff. Of course, that's the reason they call getting through school commencement. It's not the end of something; it's the beginning of something. And again, my greatest learning experience was on my own. And the thing that I'll give college and grad school credit for teaching me is teaching me how to learn. And that I think they helped me with a great deal. But again, for you, Ellen, and for me, this is an extremely active time of my life, and I've never enjoyed it more, and I've never felt in my entire life that I've done anything more important than what I'm doing now, and it's what I want to do from now until I can't do it anymore. Oh, we're getting near the break. Just a word or two. I think we're going to take a break, but let's segue into your other article about this glorious mayor of Richmond, California. Say a couple of words about her, Ellen, and then we'll take a break and we'll come back and jump right back into her again.
Well, she will be taking properties by eminent domain that are underwater. These are mortgages that on properties that are worth far less than the mortgage was for, because it was contracted during the housing bubble where prices were much higher. And they haven't, this is ruining the property values in Richmond, which is, her other issue is Chevron, which is also ruining the property values in that very poor city in the San Francisco Bay Area. But they're getting a lot of pushback from the banks. The banks are threatening to sue for unconstitutional taking without due process and for breach of contract. And because of this, Richmond's having trouble now getting credit, and there's the threat that they won't, that the homeowners won't be able to borrow anymore because of this blatant breach of their agreements. So what I wrote about was that there's a way around this, that if Richmond can show that the banks don't actually own the properties, then there's nobody to take from, and so their arguments are void. And they can show that there's nobody who owns the properties because of the way the whole securitization scheme which was set up, which is inherently fraudulent. It's very convoluted, and it's done for fraudulent purposes. So that's what I wrote about.
Well, the mayor's name is Gail McLaughlin. And anybody who will take on Wall Street is a hero of me and this program, for certain, and I imagine at least most of my listeners. Let's take a break, Ellen, and we'll pick up on Gail McLaughlin's campaign against Wall Street, and we'll cheer her on. We'll be right back. Welcome back. On with Ellen Brown. Hope the audio is coming in all right. I can barely hear the band playing in the background. Oh, it's playing all right. I hope listeners can hear it okay. Ellen, I love the way you began your article on Gail McLaughlin, again, the mayor of Richmond, California. And I'll just add one thing. She matched Star Trek, Ellen. She has gone where no woman dared go before. So I'll let you continue the story of Gail McLaughlin.
Well, I'll also point out that she's a green, and I'm running as a green on the Green Party ticket for state treasurer on a state bank platform. And the advantage of the Greens is they don't take corporate money. I mean, the disadvantage is that they don't take corporate money, and therefore they rarely win. But she did manage to win as mayor, and therefore she can stand up to the banks and she can stand up to Chevron because she's not beholden to their campaign money. So she attempted to take underwater properties by eminent domain, but they're one vote short, so they're still working on it. But meanwhile, the banks had sued last summer, but the court said that it was premature because she hadn't actually taken any properties yet by eminent domain. But that did cause their credit rating to go down, they had trouble getting borrowing money after that, and there's other cities are afraid to try it because of the threat of the banks that if that's done, that nobody will make loans in those areas anymore, and they won't be able to homeowners won't be able to fund their purchases. So there's all this pressure, pushback from the banks. So the question is what to do about that. So that was what I was writing about, that they will not have a claim in court if they can't prove that they own the properties or that the trustees for these REMICs, the real estate mortgage investment conduits that ostensibly own the property, they don't own the property either because the properties were never conveyed into the trust in time under the pooling and servicing agreements that govern these securitizations. And that's not just true here and there, like from sloppy bookkeeping. It's true for all of them, apparently, according to attorneys working in this area. And why is that? It's they had to do it that way in order to pull off this scheme, which really is a scheme. It's a sleight of hand done to try to comply with the different conflicting rules. So it's done for the REMICs, the real estate mortgage investment conduits, which are set up in order to for certain tax benefits. There have to be two true sales before the mortgage-backed securities get into the REMICs. The REMICs themselves, the trusts, are supposed to be bankruptcy remote, which means they can't contain any assets. It's all very complicated, and I'm probably not making it very clear here talking about it. But so they do contain assets, and they don't contain assets. The assets are never transferred into the trust until they actually foreclose on the properties. But their pooling and servicing agreements say that the assets are transferred within a certain cutoff date, like back in 2005 or something. There's only a few months during which the thing is set up that the properties are supposed to be transferred into it. So while they're sitting there not being owned by anybody, the mortgages are signed in blank. That means they're signed by the borrower, but they're not signed by the lender. They're not signed until the very end when they go into foreclosure or they're sold. So while they're being mortgages in blank, they trade sort of like money. They're like they're bearer notes. Anybody who holds them can collect on them. So they can be used as collateral in the repo market. So here you have these investors who think their money has gone into a trust that owns these properties. So they think their money is backed by mortgages, but the mortgages aren't really there yet. So it's a fraud on the investors. The investors are going to get stuck with the bad mortgages, but they don't have them in the meantime. And in the meantime, the bank is using them as collateral in the repo market. The repo market involves purchases and sales. It's a short, very short-term loans of collateral or purchases and sales, sales and repurchases of collateral in order to back these loans. So they can't sell it if it already is owned by this trust that has irrevocably gotten the property. So they're juggling all these things at once to do. They use the collateral for more than one deal at a time. There are many cases where that's been found. It's rather like the banks use deposits use capital under fractional reserve lending for more than one loan at a time. But it doesn't work under real estate law because you have to have this wet signatures. You have to be able to show at the county recorders that the property went from A to B to C to D with wet signatures on the paper, like real signatures of the real people it's all recorded at the county recorders. So the county recorder, the county itself, obviously has a clear interest in seeing that the title is clean, and they don't have that. County recorders' records have been totally corrupted all across the country to the loss of, it's been estimated, $1 trillion collectively for all the county recorders because they haven't gotten the recorder's fees for the transfer of all these deals. So it seems to me that when Richmond or any other city goes in and argues about this, they can say, our county recorder has a clear interest in preserving clear title. They can't show clear title. And therefore, by law, these properties, I'm not even sure how you say that, E-S-C-H-E-A-T, that by law they return to the state. They revert to the state. If nobody can prove who owns something, it reverts to the state. So, and of course, through the county where it's owned, where the property resides, so through the county. So the county gets these by default. I mean, they're actually legally entitled to these properties because title can't be established. So that's my argument.
Oh, and terrible. Just terrible. But as you point out, real estate is something very tangible. And, I mean, if a piece of property, I mean, it actually exists as opposed to lending where banks literally create money out of thin air, out of nothing. And every time a bank makes a loan, it's creating money and increasing the money supply. And every time a loan is paid off, the money supply shrinks. And I think you've written a number of times, Ellen, that the money supply keeps going down because more people are paying off loans than the banks are making new loans. So here we have all this quantitative easing going on, and yet the money supply is going on. And at first blush, it would seem like, well, how can that be? If the Fed is creating all of this money, billions of dollars every month, and the money supply is going down, well, it's going down if more loans are paid off than are created. So we've got this crazy system, Ellen. I think the banks want to keep the system very much confusing to people who just take a brief look at it and have no idea what's going on. They don't want people to know what's going on. They don't know what their racket is in detail, so they get away with all this stuff, and it goes on and on and on. And I can remember, I'm certain I've mentioned it on this program, when the only course in money and banking I took in grad school was a very obscure course. It taught me everything about money and banking I didn't want to know. And what I learned later on my own and through your articles, Ellen, was the stuff that they should have taught that they never did. They just concentrated on a lot of formulas that you had to memorize and regurgitate back, mainly in English, and then completely forget about it once the exam was over with. It was the one course I took in graduate school that I really disliked immensely, and every time I think about it, I remember why, and I still think I have my textbook someplace. Should have taken it out and burned it a long time ago, Ellen. Absolutely worthless. I think the guy who wrote it was a rather noted figure, but he didn't teach me anything. I'm not certain he taught anybody anything reading his text.
Yeah.
You had to get out in the real world, Ellen, to really know what money and banking are all about.
Yeah. We've been hoodwinked in many things. I know you're going to talk about Ukraine and Venezuela, and there too, it's the parties that own the media that establish what people believe about things. I mean, our beliefs are totally wrong, and our beliefs are based on the information that we've been fed, and the information we've been fed is from the parties who profit from that particular characterization of things. But fortunately, we're at the point in history where we have this amazing internet and this amazing, I mean, I hate to promote Google, but the very idea that you can ask any question that comes to your mind, you can just ask that up there in the top line or frame the answer that you think is think might be true, frame that up there in the top line, and voila, you can find all these articles that have already been written establishing your point or revealing what you suspected might be out there. So we have these amazing tools now for seeing through what's been fed to us, this garbage that's been fed to us, garbage in, garbage out. So there is the possibility of seeing the other side, seeing the light, breaking through. And that's what I find so interesting about this thing I call retirement, where I get to explore all these issues that, like you said, they never taught us in school, or they taught us the wrong way in school. And we have to break through that shell of misinformation.
Absolutely. And we were back in school before the Internet age. There certainly was no Internet age when I was back in school in the 1950s. And I mentioned it on this program very briefly. At the University of Pennsylvania, it housed the original ENIAC computer. I mentioned it on my Friday program. Saturday program, I guess it was, where I was literally in the room with this ENIAC computer, this giant computer with I don't know how many technicians running around, and it looked like thousands of light bulbs flashing on and off and on and off, and I figured that these guys were in the room just there to change light bulbs. And that was the state of the art of computer technology in those days. And now on my desktop, I have infinitely more power than that giant ENIAC with the dozens of technicians running around. And I don't have any flashing light bulbs, but it truly is wondrous, Ellen. And I'm amazed. I mean, I'm no fan of Google in terms of what their mission is. They're very closely tied to the Bilderberg Group. They got initial seed money from the CIA. So they have a very nefarious background and very nefarious now. And the head of Google, Schmidt, Eric Schmidt, whatever his name, forget his first, maybe Eric Schmidt, one of his missions, one of his goals in life is to see to it that privacy no longer exists. But it's amazing to me that I can Google anything and do the research that we do, Ellen. And so often, I want to find one of my old articles that I have information in that I don't want to research. And I start Googling to find the appropriate article. It could be in more than one article. And most often, not every time, sometimes you need to get the right words in to find the article that you want. But most often, I've written so many hundreds of articles. Most often, I can do a Google search and find the article that I want. It's truly astonishing to me. It's wizardry. It's absolute wizardry to have something like this. I mean, I could make a hard copy of everything I wrote. It'd be impossible to go through those hard copies and find the stuff that I'm looking for. I mean, I could spend 3 days just going through my hard copies to find something. Think of all the time I'd waste. And instead, in a very short time, I can find what I want. Usually, I mean, there's a lot more than one thing I want. When we do a Google search, Ellen, we're looking for a lot of things on a lot of different aspects of what we're writing about. But if we couldn't do that, I, for one, would be dead in the water. I couldn't do what I'm doing now. And I remember the way we used to research things back in school, Ellen. You went to the library. You looked through Rolodex cards. You went through library stacks. No wonder I hated term papers. Talk a little bit about Venezuela and Ukraine. And the only thing I'd like to discuss it in terms of, we discussed it yesterday on the program. It's a very, very major subject, and I've got two more articles on them coming tomorrow. One, I did something for the first time, Ellen. I wrote an open letter to Obama. I guess I should put his first name in. I have the title, an open letter to Obama. If I'm going to write him an open letter, I think I ought to use his full name, so I'll change the... I'll change my title and I'll put the Barack in before Obama, but my opening line is congratulations, Mr. President. I can't imagine ever making a comment like that. Well, my next comment destroys the congratulations. You're the latest in a long line of lawless leaders. You achieve rogue status without really trying, and I go on from there with a very, very lengthy introduction. There really is a lot of the meat of my article, and then I get into Ukraine, I get into Venezuela, and I talk about the stuff that he's doing. But there's a lot of money stuff wrapped up in this, the idea of plundering countries to loot them of their resources, to loot them of their wealth. This is what the dirty game is all about. Venezuela, to at least some extent, has public control to some extent over its money. The Bank of Venezuela is not like the Federal Reserve. I think in some respects it is, but in other respects, the government of Venezuela has a lot of control over the way money is created and handled and so on. And I did a very quick search on Ukraine, Ellen. I'm not certain I got this right, but it looks like to some extent Ukraine may be run the same way. Not a Federal Reserve system, but something where the state has at least a good amount of control over the state's money. So at least in part, the state is creating its own money, which is the definition of a public bank. Now, those are two good reasons for wanting to topple these governments and replace them with a typical pro-Western one, certainly of any of the Islamic states that eschew usury. So Iran is that way, a very good reason to want to topple Iran. Syria, I imagine, the same way, a good reason to want to topple them. Libya, the same thing. If a nation controls its own money, that is a prime reason why Washington wants to topple the leadership and put in a pro-Western one, get a pro-Western banking system installed. That alone is reason enough to go after these governments. I think you'd agree on that, Ellen.
Yeah, I do agree. In Venezuela, Chavez had nationalized many of the big banks, and what had set up this program where the banks were required to serve the local economy, which was great. I mean, that's what they should have done. But he had huge pressure, of course, from the CIA. I mean, they were always trying to topple him, and now this poor guy that's in now, who's even less, you know, he doesn't have the charisma of Chavez, is even more subject to those forces. I mean, it's just, all these coups, I don't know about all, but, you know, typically you can look at these coups, and we're probably behind them because we don't like the government that we're now trying to topple.
Oh, indeed. It's been a 15-year battle by the, starting with Bill Clinton, little bit under Clinton. Chavez came into office in February 1999, died April last year, murdered. He didn't die accidentally. He was murdered.
Murdered Obama, by cancer, right.
Cancer, well, whoever heard, he had the best medical care in the world. Whoever heard of having four cancer, major cancer operations in 18 months, and it couldn't save him. Couldn't save him. He was murdered. I don't know what the devil they infected him with. Maybe one day they'll find out, but he's gone. Nicolas Maduro replaced him. You're right. I think Maduro is as committed as Chavez. And the things that he says, what he says and the body language comes across very well to me. But Chavez took a while to earn his charisma, and it really began before he became president. Began in the 1990s, because in 1992 he tried an aborted coup against a very, very call it a ruthless regime, a regime that really ripped off the people and caused immense misery and hardship and poverty and so on in the people. And as a military officer, he led a coup against this for something better, and it failed. And somehow he came back from that status, because they could have put him away forever. He came back, and then it looked like he'd be a long shot to be elected in 1998. But he was elected. I think he surprised the powers that be, and he never looked back. And here, 15 years later, and as hard as three U.S. presidents tried to topple him, including an aborted two-day coup in April 2002, they couldn't do it, and they're going after Maduro again now. They want him out. I think the people of Venezuela have something to say about this even more. They're less stupid than the people of Ukraine, especially the young people that, Ellen, we talked about with Paul Craig Roberts on Friday, talked about the young people of Ukraine. I believe the term that he used was calling them ignoramuses. They don't remember what happened in 2004, a decade ago, the so-called Orange Revolution, when the current president was Yanukovych, Viktor Yanukovych, was president then, and they claimed that he won by fraudulent means, which he did not. He won a legitimate election, but they had a recall election. They had the Supreme Court to be in on the scam. They had him ousted. There was a new election. They had another guy replace him, who at one point was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Ukraine, I think run differently than it's run out of run by Yanukovych. And in 2010, this guy caused such misery in the country that they got rid of him with another election, and they reelected Yanukovych again, and now they want to get rid of him again. So there's a coup d'etat plot, and my second article for tomorrow is called Ukraine, : Coup Plotters Consolidate Power. Well, they usurped it. They usurped it on Saturday. Cheers coming out of Washington. You know, diplomatic cheers.
Well, they wouldn't join the European Union, which is a tool of the bankers.
Oh, indeed. We're just about out of time, but I'll just say, I think that was a pretext. I don't know why Yanukovych ever agreed to negotiate possibly entering the EU, which really is a scam, just to rip off the people. You know, the rich elites in the country and the corporations make out, but the ordinary people of a country that gets into the EU, they get terribly harmed. And the EU is really a dying construct. It's a sinking ship. And I don't know, rats jump off a sinking ship. They don't jump on a sinking ship. But the deal is to get Ukraine into the EU. The country conceivably could split because in the eastern part they're more aligned with eastern interests, with Russia, China as well, I would imagine, because the benefits of going that way. But the western part of the country is more Western European oriented. But Obama practically endorsed the coup d'etat, and Britain came out about as strongly as anybody endorsing the coup d'etat in less than so many words. But the message was very, very clear. They endorsed the new government. It's a coup government. Oh, my goodness, Ellen, I need to wrap it up. But I certainly will be following this, and I'm certain I haven't written the last article on just what's happened in the last few days. But it's a deplorable situation, and I expect the ignorant Ukrainian youth to get a little bit older and more mature and realize they've been had and do something about it. The Orange Revolution was overturned. I call this one Obama's 2.0 revolution, Orange Revolution 2.0, whatever you want to call it. I think Ukrainians will wake up at some point and overthrow this one. But how much more misery do they have to go through before it happens? Ellen, many, many thanks. I got to say goodbye.
Thanks, Stephen. Great talking to you.